Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. For over a century, flow in the Herring River tidal estuary in Wellfleet and Truro has been constricted by the Chequesset Neck Dike and other man-made structures. There are plans to replace the dike and restore tidal flow to the river. The goal is to improve water quality, restore marsh habitat, and enhance fish migration and shell fishing. Over the past 100 years, infrastructure, including roads, structures, and power lines, were installed in what used to be tidal marsh. Part of the Herring River Restoration Project plan is to mitigate impacts to this infrastructure, which will occur on both public and private lands. While many people recognize the benefits of restoring tidal flow to the Herring River, some have concerns about the impacts to private property, the scope of the project on the business and tourist economy, the aesthetics of elevated roadways, and questions about who's liable if things don't go as planned. Today, we discuss the research behind the proposed project, the different phases for implementation, and some of the concerns residents and property owners have about the scope and impact of the project. And we encourage listeners' comments and questions this hour. You can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. or call 866-999-4626. Joining us in studio, Carol Ridley. She's the project coordinator for the Herring River Restoration Committee. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Mindy.
Brian Carlstrom, superintendent of the National Seashore.
Good morning. Good morning, Mindy.
Bill B. Winga is the chair of the Herring River Stakeholders Group. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
And Tim Smith is restoration ecologist at the National Seashore. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
We did ask a representative from the Cape Cod Commission to join us today since they'll be instrumental in the permitting of the project. They declined, citing the fact that they haven't yet received a permit application for the project. So let's just start with the location of the project and ownership of the land that'll be impacted. What is this? Carol, why don't you kind of start there? What kind of area are we talking about?
Well, the Herring River system is about 1,100 acres located in Wellfleet and Truro out on the Outer Cape. I think what's important to note here is that the vast amount of this area is within the Cape Cod National Seashore boundary and is owned by the Cape Cod National Seashore. So in the first phase of the project, which is the phase of the project for which we're seeking permits, about 95% of that land is actually in and owned by the Cape Cod National Seashore. There's actually a very, very small percentage of land that is privately owned. So I think that's one fact we want to stress. Less than 2% of the acreage that's affected in this first phase affects private residential parcels. And we've worked very, very closely with property owners to make sure that they understand the project and to evaluate and ensure that if any structures are affected in that first phase, that that's addressed, that those structures are protected. At this point, in addition to the seashore, there are three parcels that have structures that require some degree of protection. And those all will be protected by flood measures that have been reviewed with the property owners. And will effectively ensure that nothing happens on their property.
And when we talk about structures with like sheds, driveways, are we talking houses? What are we talking about when we say structures?
So any part of the built environment. So it could be a well, it could be a driveway, a septic system, or a house. In the case of the parcels that are involved, we're talking about a couple of access ways, driveways, and a well, and I think so the degree of protection is significant, and this was a very involved process that was very science based, and I think that's an important thing to stress as well. Mm-hmm. Every effort was made to conduct high resolution surveys of these properties and to work very closely with the property owners. So in the very few instances, and I say there are three out of the entire 570 acres that will be restored in the first phase. Every effort was made to work with those property owners, and anything proposed on their property had to be done with their agreement. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the history of the river, how and when and why it was modified to its current configuration. Who wants to take that? Go ahead, Tim.
Sure. So the river historically, it's about a four-mile river from Wellfleet Harbor, heading up to a series of freshwater cattle ponds at the headwaters, Herring Pond, Higgins Pond, Gold Pond. For thousands of years, it was open to full tidal flow from Cape Cod Bay and Wellfleet Harbor. In 1908, roughly, the town decided to build a dike across the mouth of the river, primarily for the purpose of controlling mosquitoes, to dry out the marshes and eliminate mosquito breeding habitat. So the dike, the river has been diked off for about 100 years. The dike was rebuilt in the 70s, and it's had a dramatic effect, a profound effect on the ecology of the river and Wolfe Harbor as well, the adjacent waters. The tidal flow in Cape Cod Bay and Wolfe Harbor, we have a 10 to 12 foot tide range, very high tide range for the Atlantic coast. The dike effectively reduces that tide range in the river to only a few feet, a foot and a half to 2 feet, which has allowed former salt marsh to become freshwater marsh or even to dry out completely. The salt marsh vegetation has completely or almost completely died back. We have a collection of freshwater and upland plant species growing at marsh, salt marsh elevations, a whole host of water quality problems, completely degraded habitat that is both a huge loss of ecological productivity for the river itself, but also is impacting in a adverse way Wolfe Harbor by allowing pollutants and sediment to flow into Wolfe Harbor and affect shellfishing areas.
So what's the long-term plan to restore habitat? Anybody want to jump in on that?
So the plan is essentially in phase one to construct a new bridge to replace the existing Chickasset Neck Dike with a bridge that would be that would include tide gates that could be raised or lowered to control the amount of water flowing into the system. There are also two secondary tide gates, one at the entrance to Mill Creek, which is a sub-embayment or sub-basin of the system, and one at Poldike Road, which is will actually be closed in the first phase of restoration to allow only water outflowing, to allow drainage out of that system, but no tidal restoration will be allowed into the upper Poldike Creek portion of the system. So I think what's important to stress here too is once the infrastructure elements are constructed and in place, and this includes any necessary road elevation or in the limited instances where measures are needed to protect structures on private properties, the three properties I mentioned, in addition to the Chickasset Yacht and Country Club, that tide restoration will happen very incrementally. So I think there's sometimes folks assume once the bridge is built, it's all going to be opened up and it's going to, you know, just flow freely. That is not the case. It's going to be a very measured, controlled implementation process. And all along, as water is increased, the water tide levels are increased within the system, there'll be very careful monitoring of the ecological responses in the system, and to ensure that what we see as it is occurring matches what the modeled predictions are. Mm-hmm. And that's going to generate additional data that can be fed into the models and increase the reliability of the outputs from those models. So it's a very, this is really utilizing cutting edge science in estuarine protection and resource management. And it's a very careful, cautious approach.
I want to bring Kevin Krieger into the conversation now. Kevin is with U.S. Geological Survey, and he's been doing some work on this for several years now on the consequences of diking and restoration. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about your research and what you're finding.
Sure. So our primary focus is on carbon storage and greenhouse gas emission consequences of management actions in salt marshes. And so some of the key features are that when a salt marsh is diked, it may either be drained or it might be impounded. And if it's impounded and freshened, it may be invaded by Phragmites. And those Phragmites areas tend to become a significant source of methane to the atmosphere. And when it's drained, what happens is that centuries worth of stored carbon in the soil is degraded by microorganisms, and it's released to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. And so what we're finding is that under natural conditions, salt marshes tend to cool climate by storing carbon in the soil. And under dike conditions, they tend to warm the climate by releasing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
Tim, you want to ask any other questions of Kevin's research that you want to hear about? No. All right. Kevin, anything else you want to add before we let you go?
Yeah, the other key feature is that that this landscape, before it was ever diked, we need to keep in mind that it was below high tide level before it was diked about 100 years ago. And we know that sea level has been rising in 100 years since. And meantime, the landscape, because it is diked, tends to lose elevation over time. And so we have rising sea level and a falling landscape. So we know that this landscape is going to transition from forest to shrub and to wetland over the next few decades, regardless of whether we restore it or not.
That leads we have a question from Tom in Wellfleet, who says, will the Herring River Restoration Project help to mitigate the effects of sea level rise in Wellfleet and Truro? Do we know the answer to that, Kevin?
It should. Under natural conditions, if we have a healthy salt marsh ecosystem, salt marshes tend to rise as sea level rises. And so if there's a successful reestablishment of salt marsh vegetation, then that salt marsh will be a higher elevation landscape that sits between the sea and people's houses.
All right, Kevin Krieger from the U.S. Geological Survey. Kevin, thanks so much for sharing that with us this morning. Appreciate your input.
Sure.
Yeah, Bill, you've been with the stakeholders group for a while now. So this has been going on for, how long has the stakeholders been? It's been a decade, right, at least?
Unfortunately, the stakeholders group has only been really in existence. We've had one meeting so far.
Only one, okay.
But, you know, I think one of the things that the stakeholders bring is the diversity of opinions and perspectives and questions and potentially positive answers to other things. So it's a worthwhile group, I think.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And I just want to add, because I think in addition to what Bill said about the stakeholders group, you mentioned, Mindy, the decade. I mean, there has been a decade of stakeholder involvement. You know, the stakeholders group was formed as a requirement of an environmental certificate from the state. But I really want to, you know, acknowledge the forward thinking of the two towns and the seashore in the way they structured the process, because they really institutionalized stakeholder engagement throughout the entire process. It was a very sort of stepwise approach. No one just dove into this project. It was looked at very incrementally, first to test the feasibility of restoration, then to explore the concepts that could be put forward for restoration, and then to develop the actual plan that we're talking about today. And at each of those steps along the way, there were opportunities for public engagement, for stakeholders to weigh in, and for the town to reaffirm and the seashore to reaffirm its support publicly through you know, official votes and measures through the select boards, the seashore, and the town meetings. So it's been a real thorough stakeholder-based process.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, you're coming into you're new to the not new to the Park Service, but new to the seashore. So tell us a little bit, getting up to speed on all of this. I know this has been in the works for over a decade. So what has this process been like for you?
First thing I did when I got to the National Seashore was go to the dike and walk around it on my own. And the fact that it's in an impaired condition is a huge deal for us. I mean, it has actually been declared under the Federal Clean Water Act by the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection that the Herring River is actually impaired. The bacteria coming out of there is so bad, it's considered a point source solution and has resulted in closure of the shellfish beds out on the tidal flats. For a portion of a national park to be described by definition as being impaired is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And we want to do all that we can to try and correct that. Greatly appreciate the support that we're getting from the Friends of Herring River and the towns of Wellfleet and Truro. And for me, as the superintendent, ultimately responsible for making these management decisions, having the baseline of information that has been developed over the last 10, 15, 20 years is of critical importance, because that's what I'm required to utilize in making decisions that are going to affect that. Mm. This is a very well thought out, highly evolved, scientifically based process. We're going through the permitting phase right now, and then we're going to be moving towards aligning funds through a multitude of different partners towards getting this done.
We were talking about the Herring River Restoration Project. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll take your calls right after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the Herring River Restoration Project with Brian Karlstrom, Superintendent of the National Seashore, Tim Smith, Restoration Ecologist at the National Seashore, Carol Ridley, Project Coordinator for the Herring River Restoration Committee, and Bill Bewinga, Chair of the Herring River Stakeholders Group. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Leah is calling from Harwich. Good morning, Leah.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing today?
Great.
My question.
Go ahead. Give us your question.
Yeah, I'm young. I'm worried about the future of Massachusetts and the Cape. And so I'm just wondering, how is this project designed to, is it designed to, and if so, how is it designed to adapt to the effects of climate change?
Thank you, Leah. Who wants to tackle that?
Tim? So thanks for the question. The project really is intended to, at least in a local, regional level, to offset some of the climate change impacts that we would expect to see. Kevin earlier talked about the direct carbon benefits, but one of the other aspects is, we have a lot of information at the seashore that some of my coworkers have developed about the effects of sea level rise currently on salt marshes around Cape Cod Bay, and we're really losing quite a bit of habitat, and the projections going forward are somewhat concerning. So the Herring River, where we have for the foreseeable future, or expect to have a controllable system where we have the ability to allow water in and control it and really manage it so that that salt marsh can thrive, is really a huge benefit. It's a very unique opportunity to restore and maintain the diversity of estuarine habitats and salt marshes in Wellfleet Harbor for the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Carol.
And I would just add on to what Tim's saying. I think the infrastructure itself is really state-of-the-art and is going to provide much more flexibility in the management of the systems. One of the comments we've received, the elevation of roadways and the improved road work is actually going to, save the town of Wellfleet millions of dollars, according to their DPW director. So we're really, in addition to all the ecological benefit, providing huge infrastructure improvement that's much more resilient in the long term.
Tim, after a century, there's different habitat in what used to be that marshland. So what will happen to the animals that currently live in the area, and how long will it take for that ecosystem to return to the marsh?
Well, as Carol said, the new bridge that's proposed and the water control structure along with it is intended to incrementally allow increases in tidal height or high tide elevation. And those changes will be fairly small, on the order of several inches per increment or per adjustment. So there will never really be a sudden influx of salt water that, animals who are occupying the floodplain would, one day all of a sudden experience being affected by salt water. The changes will first occur within the stream channels with increased flow back and forth confined to the channels themselves, and eventually start to rise a little bit above onto the marsh surface. Those areas right now are really probably not well used by a lot of the freshwater and upland-based animals that would be there now. And by the time it does sort of spread further into those areas, there definitely would be the chance for those species to migrate into the surrounding area, which is almost all national park, undisturbed habitat, thousands of acres of suitable habitat for those animals to move to.
Room for them to go. Okay, go ahead, Bill.
Absolutely.
Another question that I have, Tim, is a few days ago in one of the meetings you had mentioned that the pH level of the water currently is about that of vinegar or, I guess, lemon juice.
Right.
Obviously, that's going to have an effect on the marine life as well. Maybe you could elaborate on that a little
bit. Sure, yeah. Some of the water quality issues that have occurred as a result of the lack of salt water have resulted in these very, very low pH or high acid areas, especially in some of the smaller ditches and stream channels. So areas that would be very, very difficult for fish and aquatic life to thrive in. A lot of the issues with the river are hard to, or impossible to see. They're in the water. Mm. Some of the landscape, you know, can look very attractive, but really, if under the water, in the water, the conditions for aquatic life is very stressful and very inhospitable.
Yeah. Leah, thanks for the phone call. Christy is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Christy.
Hi. I've been hearing a lot about a memo that was released at the Board of Selectmen's meeting. Can I hear more about that?
Do you know what she's talking about, memo?
I believe she may be referring to a document that was just discussed this past week at the Wellfleet Board of Selectmen's meeting. Getting back to one of your original questions, Mindy, about effects on private property and liability, that's been a question out there. And the council, the town council that is shared by Wellfleet and Truro, produced an opinion on this matter that the selectmen and the town administrator in Wellfleet just released publicly this week. And that essentially says that the measures the project has taken, so the fact that phase one has really limited the scope of private property that's affected, incorporates, you know, multiple levels of tide control that is going to be sort of implemented incrementally and using an adaptive management, sort of structured decision-making, ongoing monitoring and evaluation process. All the steps that the project is using to limit the scope and potential impacts to private property and to control implementation, in council's view, substantially limited any potential liability that the town would face. Mm-hmm. And this was an important document because that question had been raised and there had been some older opinions that had been issued by council prior to any of the new developments in the project design that didn't reflect all of that. And so it was very important news to share that the project measures built into it, into its design and implementation, really substantially limit any potential for liability to the town.
Christy's question, it was about liability, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. So what recourse do impacted parties have and who will be financially liable if for loss of wells or structures or businesses if they're impacted?
So I just want to stress again the limited scope of the number of properties that are involved here and the careful science-based approach to assessing what could happen on those properties and dealing proactively. I think that's important. Dealing proactively in the very limited, I think I mentioned three cases where there are structures on private properties that need to be addressed, and that's the club is a separate case. So that's important to note. You know, obviously, no one has a crystal ball, and if something were to happen in the future, and again, things will be monitored as implemented. So change, if things aren't working out through the implementation as modeled, we're going to know that well before it reaches any private property. But nevertheless, putting that all aside for a moment and saying, you know, who knows what can happen if a property owner feels that something has happened to affect a structure on their property, they would certainly be able to contact their local officials to discuss the proper course of action. You know, folks are looking for some specificity about what that process will be and who exactly they should call. That's, you know, human nature. We all want to know. I think that that's under discussion. This is all several years away when that potential could even, you know, be a reality. And so that there's plenty of time to work out that process. But again, I think putting the question of liability in proper context, I think, is really vital here.
Go ahead, Bill.
Another consideration when it comes to liability is the current state of the dike. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody could mention the safety aspects of the current dike and what might happen, in the future. We know what happened in the 70s. You could also explain that so that mm-hmm. we take liability and put it in a number of perspectives.
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, you know, the dike was first built 1909-1910 and had to be rebuilt in the 70s, and that was because the tide gates that were originally installed had failed. There were metal hinges that controlled the valves and when they rusted, there was little or no maintenance done. And by the 70s, so roughly, say, 60, 65 years after the dike was first built, the tide gates rusted, and they were partially open and leaking, so they weren't closing on an incoming tide, and started causing flooding problems to the golf course and other areas. So now, here we are, it was rebuilt in the early 70s, and we're getting on to that 60, 65-year period now, you know, 40 years or so at this point. But honestly, to say that, you know, there has been very little maintenance again, and these tide gates are in poor condition, the hinges are rusting. There's some thought that maybe they're beginning to leak. So they could leak, they could not open or close properly, or they could fail entirely, fall off during a storm. And if that were to happen, that could be catastrophic. Yeah. To the town.
Say, Maureen has a question. If the restoration project does not go forward, is there any risk of the dike failing, collapsing, or eroding? And what is the liability to the town if that happens?
Well, yeah, all indication is that the dike itself is really not in bad shape. It's the tide gates that would much more likely be a problem than the dike itself.
Right. Let's talk to Bob, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Bob.
Yes, good morning. I think that Kevin actually addressed the question that I had. It was, first off, let me start by saying I think this is a great idea, this project of restoring the wetlands to, you know, what they're naturally intended to be and to undo the damage caused by the original dike. But my question was also about seawater level rise and the effect that that's going to happen with the inevitable climate change and, you know, the rising sea levels that we have. So I think my question actually has been answered.
Well, thanks for holding,
Bob. Unless you want to elaborate more on that.
Does anybody else want to add anything to that? No.
Well, I guess I'd maybe just add that, you know, for the Outer Cape in general, sea level rise is much more affected by ocean levels than levels in the river. So there's been questions about the effect of the restoration on groundwater and other hydrologic effects, but really the ocean levels on either side of the Cape are really the controlling factors. And again, we have the ability to manage the system for some period of time to maintain the salt marsh habitat that would be negatively affected with continued rates of sea level rise that we've been seeing.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Carol.
Well, I was just going to say, just picking up on something Bob said about the idea of coastal restoration, and just, you know, there are a number of projects here on the Cape that some of which have been implemented. The Muddy Creek Restoration is one that was, you know, very, very successful. Parker River, Coonamessett River, I believe, here in Falmouth. Numbers of projects across Massachusetts. I just think there's a growing recognition that, you know, the ill-fated decisions to block off the tidal flow to these wetlands was, you know, really had consequences that we have an opportunity to address. And the benefits coming back to the communities in terms of, you know, the economic resources and also the ecosystem services that these wetlands provide, I think we're all, you know, learning about that and understanding the true benefit of that.
Yeah. There's been some questions raised about the construction of the project, the large trucks, the excavation, it being a small rural community that relies on seasonal tourism. So the question is, what are the potential impacts on tourism and business in the region? And then on the flip side, Martha says, could the panel address the expected economic benefits from the restoration project?
Well, I'll start and then others can chime in. You know, we think there's going to be significant economic benefits to, you know, to the restoration, starting with the impacts to the fisheries. Brian mentioned earlier the fact that hundreds of acres of harvestable shellfish beds have been closed due to the point source contamination from the bacterial levels in the river currently. That will be addressed. And there's, you know, the potential expectation that those would be reopened and reavailable to harvest. There's going to be greater recreational opportunities. Fishing is, you know, currently people are fishing on one side of the dike. It's going to be open to fishing either, you know, at the new bridge or up into the river. canoeing and kayaking, safe access to canoeing and kayaking for about 6 miles of waterways is going to be available. You know, huge draw. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. So in terms of the economic benefits from to the shellfishing industry, which is a, you know, I think the oysters are about a $4 million a year industry, upwards of 200 jobs in Wellfleet associated with that industry that will be, you know, augmented by this effort, in addition to the tourism benefits. I mentioned before the cost savings to the towns resulting from the roadway improvements, the enhanced infrastructure and coastal resiliency that will have economic benefits down the road. So many, many levels. In terms of the construction impacts, it is it's a series of construction projects at the bridges and the dikes and the roadway elevations. As with any public works project, these happen all the time on the Cape. The Muddy Creek Bridge I was very involved with was a major bridge building. There's a traffic management plan that's developed, and it's developed with local officials. It's developed with the local police and fire officials. It's, you know, subject to public input, and every effort is made to minimize disruption to businesses, to residents. And much of the work, I think it's important to stress, is going to be happening during the off season. It's not going to be happening during this middle of the summer. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, that's just not when it's going to happen. So I think that many, many measures will be taken to offset and mitigate any of those potential roadway impacts.
Anybody else want to add anything? You summed it up, I guess, Carol. Okay. Let's talk to Judith, who's calling. She's in a butter. Hi, Judith.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I've been impressed with how much I've been kept informed of everything that's going to happen and what possible effect it might have on my particular parcel of land where I have some trees and things that mm-hmm. I care about. But it seems to me the overwhelming benefit to the entire community, both the people who make their living harvesting from the ocean and the recreation. Just having cleaner water is important because I have grandchildren who mm-hmm. come here. So what will happen if it doesn't happen in terms of the recreational use and also possible bad things that could happen to the shellfishing industry?
Tim?
Well, the export of bacteria from the river into at least the area immediately adjacent to the dike, the area in the gut of the harbor, that would continue. There's no really reason to expect that would change or improve by itself. It's been a chronic, ongoing impact to that designated shellfish area, which is permanently closed. Whether it got worse or not is hard to foresee, but also the deterioration of the tide gates, as I mentioned before, the possibility of failure of a catastrophic event allowing a very sudden influx of salt water could lead to all sorts of problems. And then as ocean levels increase, that is, you know, increasing groundwater levels regionally throughout the area. So without the tidal flow, the high tide and low tide occurring in the river, that's going to continue to have increasing effects both on the Heron River floodplain and all of the low-lying areas in Wellfleet and Touro and the surrounding area.
Go ahead, Bill.
I assume, Tim, that the acidification would also continue to rise, and that would have an adverse effect on the herring population, which would also have an adverse effect on the other fish that people fish for, so that the fishing would probably be diminished over time if the restoration doesn't take place. In the past, they've lost oyster beds as a result of that, the acidification, and potentially that could continue on towards Wellfleet proper. So that would also adversely affect oystering. And I've been told, I've only lived here for 5 years myself, but I've been told that you used to be able to kayak all the way from the dike up to the headlands, headwaters. And currently you'd need a machete to get through there. Yeah. So that isn't going to improve either.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More of your questions after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the Herring River Restoration Project with Brian Carlstrom, Superintendent of the National Seashore, Tim Smith, Restoration Ecologist at the National Seashore, Carol Ridley, Project Coordinator for the Herring River Restoration Committee, and Bill Bewinga, Chair of the Herring River Stakeholders Group. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Lynn in Wellfleet says one benefit of allowing greater tidal flushing of the river will be that the water quality will improve and the shellfish beds that are closed in the area will be reopened. When greater tidal flushing first begins, after 100 years of buildup of animal waste on the banks of the river, how long will it be before the water quality of the bay starts to improve?
Well, that's very dependent on the speed of the pace of the restoration, how quickly these changes are made. We do expect there to be a significant amount of dilution of bacteria as it flows from the river to the harbor. By the time it reaches out into the harbor where the aquaculture areas are, we don't expect there to be a problem. That will be monitored. That's one of the many variables that we'll be looking at. And if there were a possibility for impacts, that would be addressed. But anything would be short term because eventually the incoming tide from the bay and the harbor will overwhelm the relatively small amount of water coming out of the river and dilute that bacteria down to very manageable levels.
And Carol, you mentioned that this process is going to be slow. I mean, we're not going to all of a sudden see all this water rushing. And so how is that? What is that plan? How long is that expected to take at this point?
Well, I think that's still under development in terms of the exact pace. But what is certain is that the process will include, there's already baseline monitoring that's occurring. So we have a very solid understanding of what existing conditions are before there's any tidal restoration. And then as that restoration is implemented incrementally, that monitoring will continue. And that's water quality monitoring. That's looking at sediment conditions. That's looking at the vegetation. It's looking at all aspects of the ecosystem. And I just want to mention, too, on the shellfishing front, I mean, this is a vital part of the economy and the culture of the town. And we've worked very, very closely with the shellfishing community. In fact, co-sponsored a couple of science forums with the Wellfleet Shellfish Advisory Board, which is the official town board representing shellfishing interests, because we felt it's important, A, to understand the questions that they have and to learn from what they see and experience out on the flats, and to make sure that the science is explained and that as we develop these monitoring protocols that they understand and participate in that to the extent possible. And we want to make sure the questions are answered proactively as we move forward.
Well, that's Mary in Wellfleet says, how will the project affect shellfish habitation in Wellfleet Harbor?
Well, in the harbor itself, you know, the shellfish are there. We wouldn't really expect it to affect the occurrence of shellfish. Shellfish are occurring in the flats right downstream. The problem is they're not harvestable because of the contamination. So cleaner water would result in larger areas for harvest. Upstream of the dike where there are some oysters or shellfish, but not as many, that would be, you know, depending on the salinity and the other water conditions, would eventually restore to shellfish habitat.
866-999-4626 is our number if you have a comment or question. It's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Carol, you mentioned the wells earlier. And so how are you determining if restoring tidal flow will impact private well water? And if people do, you mentioned there's, you know, process and stuff that will be in place. So are you monitoring where this might impact wells?
Sure. So just to start it with, I think that there's a lot of science that's been done to understand the effects of, you know, what happens with salt water and freshwater and groundwater, you know, at the coastline. So there's a whole body of science telling us how these relationships, you know, work in nature. In addition to that, we've done an exhaustive review of all of the structures, including wells, that are in the floodplain that could be affected by the restoration. So we know where they're all located and whether they're likely to be in a situation that would cause any effect. And we, at this point, there was one well identified that is now will be protected from any effect. So I'll let Tim maybe talk about some ongoing monitoring that the seashore has done with groundwater wells.
Sure. Well, there's a whole raft of monitoring going on. much of it is being done through the amazing efforts of my friends and colleagues at the Seashore Natural Resource Division, who have done exhaustive amount of work over many years to understand all of the ecological functions occurring within the system. With respect to groundwater, we have been working with U.S. Geological Survey on a fairly extensive network of groundwater monitoring wells within the Mill Creek sub-basin. There's been some other groundwater wells long-term in other areas of the floodplain as well for the past 10 to 12 years or so.
John is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm just curious about, and I don't think you've mentioned it yet, unless I'm mistaken, but the financing of this whole project, mm-hmm. It seems to me, with everything everybody's talked about, it's going to cost a great deal of money.
Yep.
And number one, do they have the money? And if they don't, how are they going to get it?
Yeah, it's a question I have on my list, John, but I haven't gotten to it yet. But thanks for bringing that up. All right. So what is the price tag and where is the money coming from? Who wants to tackle that? Brian?
Yeah, I'm happy to take a crack at that. The project is substantial. It's about $47 million in total. It's going to be phased. It's going to take place over several years with a multitude of state, local, and federal partners in order to meet that number. Park Service has got some projects in development to get things moving. A substantial amount of funding has been put together on this to get it to where it is right now with the environmental impact statement. It's been very successful in that regard. The state is willing to step forward to continue to put money towards this effort simply because it is impairing a water resource and an important saltwater marsh that needs help. Hmm. So it is understood as a really substantial number to come up with funding towards. But just last week, we were meeting with the Natural Resource Conservation Service. They believe in this project. They know it's got potential to really improve things and are going to continue to work with us, with the Herring River Group, to make sure we can get the funds secured to do this. You know, it's going to take place over several years. The earliest we expect any construction to start happening is still 2 to 3 years out. Mm. With the federal budget cycles, nothing is ever certain until mm-hmm. it's there. But things are in the works towards that end. Right. And Carol's got something
to add.
I just wanted to add that I think oftentimes there's a sense that, you know, we should have the funding in place now. And that's honestly not how projects of this nature work. Typically, you have permits. And in fact, having permits and being well into the permitting process enhances your chances of obtaining funding. So we are actively working with our federal partners on this. And we feel we're right on track to have those resources in place when we need them. And Brian mentioned the state commitment as well, which is really significant. They have included about 25% of the construction cost in the state capital budget. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the pieces are getting into place and at the proper time.
Right. Go ahead, Bill.
Also, I believe there's has been funding that has also started. We've collected money already.
Correct.
You might
right.
Elaborate
yes.
On that.
So, you know, the project has been in development for over a decade now. So that's over that period of time through various grants from federal and state agencies. The project is, I think the number is somewhere in the range of $7 million has been raised to do the work to date. Mm-hmm. So those are substantial commitments, and we expect that to continue.
Shay has questions. Is it true that the main ingredient in Roundup was to be used for eliminating Phragmites in the original plan? Is it still, and if not, what is the plan to deal with the unwanted vegetation, including forest and existing vegetation?
So this was a conversation that took place about a year ago. The Restoration Executive Council, which is the policymaking group under the memorandum of agreement that the seashore and the two towns have to move forward with the project, agreed not to include the use of herbicides in the permits. So the permits will not include the use of those materials. That was an important decision. But there are a number of other methods that are available to manage vegetation, which is going to be an important part of this. And Tim's probably in a better position to address those.
We expect to be managing large amounts of both woody vegetation and Phragmites. We feel that the saltwater flooding will be very effective in eliminating much of the Phragmites. Mm-hmm. There's a possibility some of it could pop up in some of these more brackish water habitats, and we would intend to use very diligent monitoring and other methods to eliminate that before it gets well established.
And Paul says, has anyone addressed the mosquito issue? What's the mosquito issue?
Well, it's a wetland, and there are mosquitoes. The dike was originally intended to eliminate mosquitoes, and that didn't really work out too well. After the dike was built, there were lots of other activities to try to address that, including channelizing the river and creating all kinds of ditches to try to drain out the marsh. So we expect with the project there would be a changeover in the dominant species type to a saltwater species as opposed to freshwater species. And because of the nature of the tidal flow and actions we intend to take on the marsh itself, we think we can manage that population to some degree by minimizing mosquito breeding habitat and ensuring that small fish species that consume mosquito larvae have access to whatever breeding habitat may exist to try to control those numbers to some extent.
And then Helen says, this seems to be an important project. What can an ordinary Wellfleet citizen do to make sure it happens? That's you, Carol.
Okay. Well, as we get into the permitting process, we'll be looking for folks to participate with letters of support and participating in the public review process of those applications. I think just, keeping informed and, participating when decisions need to be made at the local level, participating at that point. We've been really fortunate that there's just a tremendous amount of support in the local community. I think we have 20 or so groups on record in the towns and the region in support of the project. It really is, I think once people understand what's at stake and understand the science behind it, it's very compelling. And so I don't think we'd be where we are today if we didn't have that support of the local community.
Right. And then Bill, of course, with the Herring River Stakeholders Group, like as you were saying, you want all those, but you want to hear everybody's thoughts and concerns because it answers a lot of questions before any problems.
Absolutely. There are a number of constituencies that are represented in the stakeholders group, and individual citizens should, contact their representatives with their concerns and their thoughts, their input. Don't hold back on the positive, it's always nice to hear the good.
Yeah.
But also, we want to be able to address the other issues that people face.
Right.
And that's why the stakeholders group has been established, so that we can get a
look
good
at
view.
That. All right. Carol Ridley, Project Coordinator for the Herring River Restoration Committee. Bill Bidwinga, Chair of the Herring River Stakeholders Group. Tim Smith, Restoration Ecologist at the National Seashore. And Brian Kostrom, Superintendent of the National Seashore. Thanks for taking the trek to Woods Hole this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy Todd.
Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.